This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
Okay, Theodore Beza then. Beza is often regarded as the man who fundamentally corrupts Reformed theology by hardening it into a predestinarian system. I think the last 25 years of scholarship on the history of Reformed thought have pretty successfully debunked that idea. By and large, the evidence for it is the famous chart that Beza has, the predestinarian chart. We have God at the top, God's glory, then divided down into election and reprobation. And the whole thing is supposed to be a logically deductive system coming from God's glory. The problem, which ironically, given the fact that many Barthians have argued for this view of Beza, Barth himself is correct on that chart. Barth's own comments in the Dogmatics indicate that he's aware that the chart is to be read from the bottom upwards, not the top down. That's how those charts operated in the 16th, 17th century, and therefore, if you're talking about it being a logically deductive system, it doesn't work. Because you wouldn't have read it top down, top to bottom, you'd have read it bottom to top, and it looks somewhat different. If you're interested in the question of the relation of Beza to Reformed theology, Richard Muller's Christ and the Decree is a good place to start. It's not the easiest book to read, but it's a good place to start. Bottom line, Reformed theology has too many influential thinkers involved in the 16th and 17th centuries, for any single thinker to have a dominant and decisive influence. Even Calvin is at best, I think, described as primus inter pares, first among equals, not as a dominant source of Reformed theology. It's unfortunate we use the term Calvinism, because that does rather give Calvin, or appear to give Calvin, a role that he never actually had. If we were studying theology in the late 16th century in England, we wouldn't be using Calvin's Institutes as our textbook. Is Eun Jin here? No, all the people I'm calling on today aren't here. Eun Jin would tell you that the textbook would be Bullinger's Decades. Heinrich Bullinger was just as big a name in many ways in Reformed theology in the 16th century as John Calvin was. Did I see Brady? I'm not going to pull your leg. You missed your moment. We were talking about John Bunyan in the first class, and I was telling everybody how you'd made me the hero of an urban pilgrim's progress. It's okay. We'll do Bunyan again next week. So if you come along, I'll be calling on your knowledge at that point. That may encourage you to stay away, of course. But James Arminius, a student of Beza, reacts strongly against Beza's predestinarianism, specifically Beza's supralapsarianism. Reformed theology late in the 16th century begins to reflect upon, the difference between infralapsarian and supralapsarianism is this. It's not a fine one, but it's in some ways a significant one. When the Lord predestines people to salvation, does he look on them, way back in the mists of time, in eternity, does he look upon them as already fallen or as not yet fallen? If he looks upon them as fallen, then knowing they're going to fall, he's saving them from damnation. If he looks upon them as unfallen, then the fall itself becomes instrumental to his election. You're really playing around with how you understand God. I think that as an aside, I think the Westminster Assembly documents are probably tending an infralapsarian direction, but were certainly subscribed by supralapsarians. For my money, the best theologian of the 17th century, John Owen, takes no position on the matter. He just doesn't address it. I think he'd regard it as too speculative. But Beza is a supralapsarian, and Arminius takes exception to this. And Arminius goes on to have a controversial career at the University of Leiden. I had the pleasure some years ago of giving a paper at the University of Leiden, and they allowed me to sit in Arminius's chair, would you believe? They still have the chair that he would sit in when he chaired disputations there. He was opposed by Francis Gomarus, and then when Arminius dies, there is a major struggle to appoint his successor. And the man that the Arminians, the followers of Arminius, want to appoint is a man called Conrad Vorstius. And Vorstius has Socinian tendencies. The Socinians are in some ways the intellectual successors of Michael Servetus. The Socinians are the intellectual forefathers of modern Unitarians. Some years ago when I was doing a bit of work on the Socinians, and I wanted to get hold of the Socinian Catechism that was put together in Poland at the beginning of the 17th century, I found a 19th century reprint put out by the Unitarian Society. Every time I drive down into Philadelphia or along Lincoln Drive, there is that magnificent Unitarian church. Now, I don't know how many people go to Unitarian churches these days. I'm guessing it's not many. It's not a pleasure at all. I had the distinctly unpleasant experience a few years ago of having to go to the funeral of a friend, a chap just a little bit older than myself, who had been a Unitarian, and it was a Unitarian funeral service, and it was bleak. No resurrection, and, you know, everybody's pretty good at heart, aren't they? It was the most unrealistic funeral I think I'd ever been to. I've never been to one of these American evangelical celebration of life jamborees. I suspect they're even more unrealistic than the Unitarian one. But the Unitarian one was bleak enough. Arminius's innovations in theology. Arminius, and I'm persuaded by Afe Decker's work on this, Arminius articulates a concept of middle knowledge. If you're a good medieval Thomist, and had I been around in the Middle Ages, I think I'd probably have been a good medieval Thomist. You divide God's knowledge into two. God has knowledge of simple intelligence, and God has a knowledge of vision. Later Scotists have slightly different terms for this, but essentially the same concept. Knowledge of simple intelligence is the knowledge that God has simply by virtue of being God. In other words, that knowledge is infinite and identical with his essence. Knowledge of vision is the knowledge that God has of that which will actually happen. Because there is no logical contradiction involved in me having antler horns, human beings having antler horns, and I can, even now as I look at Brandon here, I can visualize him in my head with a pair of antlers. Because I can do that, I assume that God must be able to do that as well. So God, according to his knowledge of simple intelligence, has knowledge of Brandon with a set of antler horns. According to his knowledge of vision, though, God only knows Brandon as he's sitting before us now. Unless he has very small antler horns hidden under, do you call them beanies here, those woolly hats? Unless they have under the beanie, there are antler horns. God knows by his knowledge of vision, not an antlered Brandon, but an unantlered Brandon. It's a distinction that is used to maintain the infinity of God, while yet maintaining the stability of God's knowledge of actual existence. In the late Middle Ages, a concept is developed that is then picked up by the Jesuits of all people and developed, and that is the knowledge that is known as middle knowledge, or scientia media, to give it its Latin term. A category that occurs between these two. This is God's knowledge of all possible worlds. Now, the brightest and best among you will be immediately thinking, ah, yes, but doesn't God's knowledge of simple intelligence carry with it knowledge of all possible worlds? Well, yes, it does. But middle knowledge involves a subtle shift in the doctrine of God as well. And this is God's knowledge of all possible worlds, rooted in an idea of God where God is not the ultimate specifying cause of everything that happens. So let's, you know, give an example of that. God has knowledge of two worlds, A and B. In world A, I'm preaching next Sunday. And Charles Williams, who thus far has safely pretended to be a Christian, but isn't really one, hears the gospel going out with power like he's never heard it before. Never heard preaching like it before. And it strikes deep into his heart. It tears him open and exposes his sin. And it points him to Christ. And Charles decides to close with Christ that day. So God has knowledge of that world. God also has knowledge of a world where Charles is the same dissembling hypocrite that he is and comes along to my church on a Sunday. I preach exactly the same sermon with the same eloquence and power that I always preach. And Charles freely and willingly and defiantly refuses to repent and turn to Christ. God knows both of those worlds according to his middle knowledge. And he decides to realize the first and not the second world. Think about the implications of that. God has determined that Charles will be united with Christ. But God has done it in a way where Charles does that freely and not because God has decreed it as such. That's where middle knowledge comes in. It's a way of trying to solve the freedom, the divine sovereignty, human freedom problem, whereby God looks forward through time and all possible worlds, and he decides to realize that world which meets that which he wishes to do. But he realizes that world in which all of those outcomes come about freely, because he has not specified that they must come out that way. Fatal flaw in the argument, of course, is what? Fatal flaw is if God has decided to realize world A and not world B, come Sunday, is Charles really free to choose Christ, or has he got to do it because option B has already been excluded by divine fiat? This is why those of you who remember the openness of God debates of the late 90s, you know, maybe 10 years ago now, which were presented by people like Clark Pinnock as a real problem for Calvinism, they're a real problem for Arminianism. Calvinism, you concede a radical limitation of human freedom right at the outset. Arminianism, what you try to do is maintain radical human freedom while yet also maintaining God's sovereignty. I remember asking Vincent Brumer, the South African open theist, if he thought that middle knowledge could solve the problem. And his response, he laughed and he said, "Calvinism and Arminianism," he said. "Do you want to get bitten by the cat or do you want to get bitten by the dog?" he said. "But you still get bitten." And I thought that was a good answer. What he meant was, human beings still aren't free. But what middle knowledge does in the 17th century is it shifts the doctrine of God slightly. And it also, of course, shifts understanding of human depravity slightly. On my account of human depravity, it doesn't matter how many possible worlds there are out there that God conceives of, two things apply. Well, one, my doctrine of God means that whatever world Charles Williams appears in to respond to the gospel, God cannot conceive of a world where God is not the cause of Charles responding to the gospel. God can't even conceive of that. It doesn't even exist as an aspect of his simple intelligence, because that would require God to conceive of a world where he was not God, and he cannot do that. And secondly, given the nature of human depravity, you know, the chances of Charles Williams being, you know, turning to Christ of his own volition are about as much as the, you know, the chances of a chimpanzee playing all of Beethoven's piano sonatas one after another if you leave him sitting on a piano stool for an infinite amount of time. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So Arminianism shifts both the doctrine of God and the doctrine of human depravity in a tiny way, but a massively significant way. The difference on one level is like that. But the implications are, it's like a gulf. It's like a gulf. Becomes an explosive political issue in Holland in the 17th century. It's partly divides along ethnic lines. The Arminian Hollanders in the north, Amsterdam and north, and the immigrants from the German lands in the south. It also plays out as a struggle between the Arminian regents, those who are looking for sort of more devolved kind of power within Holland, and the stadtholder, the equivalent of the king. He's not really a king, but the emerging head of state who will bind the whole nation together. Arminianism also appeals to merchants. Why would Arminianism appeal to merchants? Dutch theology is fascinating because it connects to Dutch cultural and economic life almost like nowhere else. I was at a party in the Netherlands once after some conference, and I was chatting to a PhD student, and I said, "What are you doing your PhD on?" And he said, "I'm doing it on the influence of the potato on Dutch Reformed theology." I said, "I'm sorry." He said, "I'm doing it on the influence of the potato on Dutch Reformed theology." I'm thinking, well, he was Dutch, so I'm assuming he speaks English better than I do. I mean, that's how it works in Holland. You get on a bus, and the bus conductor speaks better English than you do. It turns out, I said, "Well, could you explain?" And he said, "Yes." He said, the potato famines had a profound effect upon pastoral theology in Holland. Then it made kind of sense. Of course, if your people are dying of starvation because the potatoes are blighted, it's going to have an impact on your theology. Why would merchants like Arminianism?
Because there's a boundless sea of goods that they can sell and acquire more wealth without limitation or...
That's human nature in general. I mean, who doesn't want a boundless sea of goods they could sell? Who are you selling this stuff to? Have you ever? I mean, Holland. Even when it included Belgium, you know, it's about the size of Pittsburgh or something. Yeah, I've stood at the top of a tower in Delft in the Netherlands, and you can see seven cities from the top of the church tower in Delft. Seven cities. It's that small a country. You've got to sell it to other people. When you're looking at Europe in the 17th century, you're looking at expanding markets. That's how you do trade. You make stuff and then you sell it to other people. You export. Who are you exporting to?
Catholics.
The French. The Spanish. The Portuguese. These are the people you're selling your stuff to. Why would Arminianism appeal to merchants? Interesting, I think Arminius was the son-in-law, I think, of a merchant. Yes. You're borrowing some concepts from Catholicism at an intellectual level. And secondly, this plays out in an understanding of justification that has more room for works. When the act of faith becomes a work, your understanding of justification is modified. Arminianism, in its 17th century form, cast, is less dogmatic on those kind of issues that divide Protestants from Catholics. It's more concessive, and it allows you to trade. If you get hold of Richard Baxter's Christian Directory, which is one of the great works of Protestant casuistry, cases of conscience, you'll find questions there. You'll ask questions, can I trade with a Roman Catholic? These are important questions in the 17th century. As the world is becoming confessionally more complicated, questions like this get thrown up. I suppose today's equivalent might be, you know, if you ran a slaughterhouse, could I have a halal section of my slaughterhouse to sell to Muslim customers? These kind of questions of everyday life pop up, and they press in on theology. So Arminianism, the Arminian debates that take place at the Synod of Dort are much more complicated than just a bunch of reform guys battling it out with Arminians. There's ethnicity at stake. There's politics at stake. There's trade at stake in these discussions. In fact, by the time the Synod's called in 1618, the Reformed have the whip hand. And if you look at that great the great lithograph or engraving of the Synod of Dort, you've got the Reformed sitting all the way around the outside, like a cast of thousands. There's a blank area for the French. The French were being persecuted at the time. The French delegate couldn't get there. And then on the table in the middle, you've got like a handful of Arminians. You know, there's no doubt which way the verdict's coming down on this one. The Synod of Dort is in many ways a show trial to run the Arminians out of town. The Synod of Dort is also interesting because it's a great example of international Calvinism. The Westminster Assembly is an English, and ultimately an English and Scottish affair. Synod of Dort is international. There are English delegates there, German delegates there. It's a gathering of international Calvinists. And it is definitive for the continental reform trajectory. The canons of Dort become part of the three forms of unity. And in the clash with Arminius, we have bequeathed to us historically the concept of Arminianism, which, you know, we've looked at Protestantism. Protestantism first fragments in 1529 between Lutheran and Reformed. Now the Reformed faith itself fragments between the Reformed and the Remonstrants, the followers of Jacob Arminius. The other thing to remember about Arminianism in the 17th century is it's always under suspicion of two things. It's under suspicion of being crypto-papist, for want of a better word, sneakily Roman Catholic, if you like, and it's also under suspicion of being crypto-Socinian. And the Vorstius case, the attempt to get Vorstius in as Arminius' successor, plays directly to the characterizing of Arminianism as Socinianism. And think about it. The hallmark of Socinianism becomes God's denial that God has knowledge of the future. It's kind of a resolution of the tensions that are inherent in Arminian doctrine of God. Yes?
A lot of evangelical Arminianism tied middle knowledge to Molina instead of Arminius.
Yeah.
And they distinguished themselves from
Arminius. Yeah. I think Molina, Louis Molina, the Jesuit, is probably the source of Arminius' thinking. And you look at William Lane Craig would be, you know, a very articulate Arminian philosopher come theologian. And William Lane Craig's wrote a book on Molina, a very good book. I don't know whether, who's the professor of theology at Biola, whose name always eludes me? Fred Sanders. Fred Sanders is more of a Wesley man, I think. I'm thinking of the philosophy guy. J.P. Moreland. I'm guessing Moreland's probably done work with middle knowledge. It's come back in an odd form in Reformed theology in Alvin Plantinga. And Plantinga and Lane Craig have both, in their different ways, proposed middle knowledge as a way that Arminians and Reformed can come together. The problem with that, of course, is it was actually middle knowledge that we fell out about in the first place. It was the point of division. As I say, as Reformed, you, as soon as you're a Calvinist, you concede dramatic limitations on human free will in the first place. I think middle knowledge, God's knowledge of the future, is more of a problem for Arminians than it is for Reformed, because we've already decided we're happy to live to a certain extent with a deterministic universe. in a way that Arminians want to try to avoid that. But I think you end up in a real bind.
So middle knowledge is something that Arminius gets from Molina, not the other way around?
No, it's Arminius is... Well, there is a debate as to whether Arminius has a concept of middle knowledge. So I'm persuaded that he does, and he's borrowing it from the Jesuits, which, of course, is another strike against him in looking a bit Roman Catholic. But John Owen borrows a lot from Jesuits and Reformed as well, but providing you borrow the sound bits, you're okay, it seems, rhetorically. You know, and Owen will borrow from the Jesuits, but always make a company, you know, even though they're godless unbelievers, they actually make a good point here, and so you quote them. So. And when he refers to Thomas, he'll refer, you know, him as one of the better of the medieval schoolmen, typically speaking. Back to England then. We've got the Arminian background. Elizabeth I dies without issue in 1603. She never married, known as the Virgin Queen. And she's kept everybody guessing up until the last minute as to where the crown is going to go. And finally, she bequeaths the crown to the son of her cousin, James VI of Scotland. James VI's mother, Mary Queen of Scots, who fled to England ultimately during the Reformation in Scotland, was imprisoned in England under house arrest, became a focus for Catholic plots, and was eventually beheaded by Elizabeth. Elizabeth did not make the mistake of her brother and sister, and that is of allowing rivals to exist and become focuses for long-running plots. James VI, who was crowned, I think, at age about 9 months, and had John Knox preaching the coronation sermon, can only imagine what traumatic damage that would have done to a nine-month-old. James VI is tutored by Robert Buchanan. Buchanan was one of the most fearsome Presbyterian intellects of his day, and by all accounts, an utterly humorless individual. By the time that James was in his teens, James was able to get the best of Buchanan in debate. James is without doubt the most intellectual monarch that England has ever, Scotland has ever had. The competition is not that fierce, but even if it had been, James would have been up there. My favourite satirical magazine, Private Eye, always has a photograph with bubbles on the front, and this week's cover is Prince Charles looking at a fruitcake at some competition saying, "Ah, a rich, nutty fruitcake," and Camilla is saying, "Oh, don't be so hard on yourself, Charles." If ever there was a totally thick individual who thinks he's an intellectual, it has to be Prince Charles. I was actually, if I can really name drop here, I was at university with Prince Edward. I never met him, but I do know that when I was an undergraduate, the rumors circulated that it was his security detail who wrote his course papers for him. So, anyway, the royal family, generally inbred and thick as two short planks. James VI, a remarkable exception to that rule. Robert Buchanan did two things instilled in him: intellectual brilliance, and he instilled in him also a deep hatred for Presbyterianism. And both of those will be significant. James is King of Scotland. He has but one. There is one moment in his life where he does something glamorous and romantic. It's decided to marry him to Princess Anne of Denmark. And Princess Anne of Denmark sets sail to come to Scotland to marry the young prince. And her ship is turned back by storms. And she has to head to Norway. And James hears of this. And he commissions a boat and 300 men. And he sets sail through the storms to fetch his bride. It is in a life marked by sleaze and general mediocrity of behavior. It's the Hallmark Channel moment, if you like. The dashing young prince sails across the North Sea to bring his young bride back. It is, even for somebody with a heart of stone like myself, it's kind of touching to think of. He's in 1603. A horseman rides north from London to Edinburgh to bring King James VI the news that the English crown is to be his. And James heads south. Hopes are high among the radicals in the English church that this man, trained by Robert Buchanan, could bring with him a Scottish Presbyterian settlement to England. James, though, is an absolutely committed Erastian, that the church is to be subordinated to the head of state, and that whatever else the Church of England will be, it will not be a Presbyterian church. A petition is presented to him. Of 1,000 signatures, it's known as the Millenary Petition, calling for further reformation of the Church of England. James calls a conference, 1605, the Hampton Court Conference, when he gathers, was it 1603, my mind's gone blank, gathers together the leading Puritan clergyman and the leading conformist clergyman, and both sides are confident that the king's going to come down their way. What the king does there is quite brilliant. He breaks the heads of both sides, and he grants the Puritans one request. The Puritans request a new translation of the Bible, and the king agrees to this. But, and here, you know, James, for all the fact he's quite sleazy in many ways, James is politically brilliant. The King James Bible is to be translated by teams, a London team, an Oxford team, and a Cambridge team. And the teams are made up of mixtures of Puritans and anti-Puritans. In other words, leading Anglican clergymen have got to work with their deadliest enemies on the king's great project. It is a brilliant move. You can buy books on leadership theory that will tell you one of the ways to be a good leader is to, you know, match up weaknesses and strengths, to get people who don't get on, force them to work together and be part of a team. James got this by in. He didn't have to read any books on theory. James does this instinctively. He wants rid of the Geneva Bible, and the Puritans play straight into his hands by saying they want a new translation of the Bible. The King James Version would be produced without notes. And in 1611, of course, the King James Version of the Bible, the authorized version, is the one that, you know, after I think the Book of Common Prayer and along with the plays of Shakespeare, King James Version of the Bible is one of the pillars of English literature and the modern English language. Cannot understand the development of literary English without understanding the King James Version of the Bible. 1605, the Gunpowder Plot. A group of disaffected Catholics hire a Dutch mercenary, Guido Fawkes, often known as Guy Fawkes, to blow up the Houses of Parliament. They tunnel under the Houses of Parliament, stockpile gunpowder. It's the most spectacular plot. I mean, the idea was you're going to, at the opening of Parliament, you see the House of Commons process to the House of Lords. They have to stand, but they're in the House of Lords. And the monarch, who is not allowed into the House of Commons, Charles I gets into serious trouble when he goes into the House of Commons. The monarch sits on the throne in the House of Lords and convenes Parliament. If you blow up Parliament when that's happening, you get rid of everybody who's governing the country. Catholic plot is put together to blow up the Houses of Parliament. Probably the plot was infiltrated by the English intelligence services. Probably. Certainly what happens just before Parliament. One of the people in the know says to a friend of his who's an MP, you may not want to go to the opening of Parliament this time. And what happens is that the plot is sort of exposed at almost the last minute. For those of you who are interested in conspiracy theories are nothing new. I mean, I was still stunned. It's like 60-70% of the American people still believe that there was some sort of conspiracy behind John F. Kennedy's assassination, I saw this week. I mean, John Kerry sort of implied that he might. I'm thinking, you're the Secretary of State. If there's a government conspiracy, man, open the books. It's kind of really idiotic for somebody with access to the information to say they believe there's a conspiracy and then not do anything about it. Anyway, that aside, theories abound that the English government knew this plot was going on but allowed it to progress to the point where it nearly succeeds so that they can crack down on Catholicism after 1605. They really come down hard on Roman Catholicism after 1605. James is vigorous Erastian. He's also almost certainly a practicing homosexual, as it happens. Appears that he had an affair with the Duke of Buckingham. One of my earliest childhood memories is my dad reading to me Charles Dickens's Child's History of England. And the description of James I in that has to be read to be believed. He's sort of picking his nose and dribbling on his beard. And, you know, as a four-year-old, it made a devastating impression on me that a king would be so absolutely disgusting as that. He was not a very pleasant person on the whole, but he's very, very sharp theologically. Reformed in theology, but Erastian and Episcopalian in church government. England and Scotland have separate governments at this point. The Act of Union, 1707, is 100 years away. So James is James the VI of Scotland, James the I of England. James starts to, what James does when he becomes King of England is, he doesn't bring Presbyterianism south of the border to England. He attempts to export Episcopalian Erastianism north of the border. In 1618, he imposes on the Church of Scotland the so-called Five Articles of Perth, essentially imposing Episcopalian practice and aesthetics upon a Presbyterian church. It provokes the emergence of a radical Presbyterian underground in Scotland that will become the powerhouse of Scottish Presbyterianism as we head into the 1630s and the 1640s. James, you see, has the problem that he will pass on to his son. He's the king of three kingdoms, England, Ireland, and Scotland. And he wants religious uniformity among the three. The difference between James and his son Charles is James is clever, Charles is stupid. James is an astute political operator, Charles is a remarkably inept political operator. The third thing is James dies just a bit too early to have achieved all he wanted to achieve. He dies in 1625, and his young son, Charles I, comes to the throne. Charles I is an abject disaster as a monarch. Charles I promotes a man called William Laud to the Archbishopric of Canterbury. Laud is used in the 1630s to impose upon the church a high ceremonialism that goes well beyond wearing a surplice in worship. You're starting to have altars and candles and things emerging within the Anglican Church that exacerbates the problems with the Puritan faction. Not only that, but Charles moves to impose not just the aesthetics of the Book of Common Prayer upon the church in Scotland. In 1637, 1638, he moves to impose an English-style uniformity on the church in Scotland. And this leads to the signing of what's called the National Covenant. Covenant thinking lies deep within the Scottish psyche by this point. Remember, Knox talks about the head of state breaking covenant with God and breaking covenant with the people. One of the ways that the people are able to show their displeasure at what their monarch is trying to do, they sign a national covenant protesting the imposition of Episcopalianism upon the nation. The famous incident may or may not have taken place at this point in St. Giles Cathedral, when the minister gets up to read, to use the Book of Common Prayer in worship. A lady called Jenny Geddes stands up. In those days, there weren't pews in churches, so if you're a man, you'd probably stand for the worship service. If you're a woman, you'd probably take along a three-legged stool to sit on. Jenny Geddes stands up and she throws her three-legged stool at the minister, shouting, "Wilt thou say the mass at my lug?" Rough translation, "You're going to say the mass in my ear hole." Not very happy. The National Covenant, signed all over Scotland by the nobility, signed also by ordinary people as well, places the Scots people effectively at war with their monarch at this point. And what we see from 1638 onwards is the rapid descent of England and Scotland into a state of civil war. Things come to a head. 1640. The king is forced to recall Parliament not once, but twice. If you want to raise taxes to fund armies, you have to call Parliament. The king has no tax-raising powers without permission of Parliament. When he calls Parliament back for the second time, Parliament opposes his proposals, uses the opportunities to oppose his religious policies, and in 1642, the king declares war on his own parliament. War lasts through to 1649 and provides the context for the Westminster Assembly. We'll talk about that a bit now, but mainly next time. In 1643, Parliament, no longer shackled to the religious policies of the king, decides that it is time to revise the Book of Common Prayer and the 39 Articles of the Church of England, and convenes an assembly of divines, of English divines, to meet and pursue that. So the Westminster Assembly is actually not a church assembly. It's convened by Parliament. By late August 1643, it's very, very clear that England needs Scottish military support to defeat the king in the war, and so sends delegates north to negotiate the entry of the Scots into the English Civil War. And they sign, the English and the Scots sign, the Solemn League and Covenant, which is interpreted by the Scots as committing the English Parliament to a wholesale imposition of Presbyterianism upon the nation should it win, should it defeat the king. That is one reason why, I'm not sure it's the case over here, but it certainly used to be the case that the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Northern Ireland did not allow its members to vote in general elections, because you could only vote for a party that was committed to imposing the terms of the Solemn League and Covenant upon the nation. You know, and there's no way the Conservative or the Labour Party today is going to impose Presbyterianism on the nation. They wouldn't even know what it means. But the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643 brings the Scots onto the English side in the Civil War and brings Scottish delegates to the Westminster Assembly, at which point the brief of the Assembly becomes much more radical. The first 11 articles of the 39 articles have been revised by the earlier Assembly. Now, everything's scrapped. They decide to build the Westminster Assembly, build the English church from the ground up by producing a series of documents that fundamentally redefine English and Scottish church life. And over the next few years, they produce a Directory of Public Worship, 1645, the form of church government in 1645, the larger and shorter catechisms of 1647 and 1648, and the Confession of Faith in 1647. We'll talk more about these documents next time, but just some general observations. Notice the priority that is given to worship and church government. You know, one of my big beefs, I guess, with the sort of emerging Reformed evangelicalism today is that its priorities are not the priorities of the Reformed world of the 17th century. And that, you know, the term to call oneself a confessional evangelical, well, to be confessional means the price one pays for that is one returns to the confessional divisions of Protestantism in the 16th, 17th century. It's ironic that one can say, well, I'm a confessional evangelical, but I don't think baptism or the Lord's Supper should be points of division. Because those were precisely the points of division that led to the forming of, guess what? The Reformed, the Lutheran confessions in the 16th and 17th centuries. But also the importance of worship. The fact that the first thing these guys go after is public worship. Now, we may not agree with the director of public worship. I think the director of public worship in some ways is caught on the horns of a dilemma. It wants to get rid of formal liturgy because formal liturgy equals Book of Common Prayer equals state imposition of bad stuff. On the other hand, it knows that you can't have any old idiot standing up in a pulpit and leading worship. So it says, you know, we're not going to have a formal liturgy, but if you pray, here's a model prayer you can read and kind of base your prayer on. So there is that sort of tension within the director of public worship. But what's interesting is public worship, if you look at the rate they're producing documents, that's the most important thing they do. That's the first thing they do. Partly, I think, because they know there is a great consensus on theology. They know that they don't have much of a beef with Anglican theology. The 39 Articles need sharpening and tweaking and elaborating in the light of the developments of Arminianism, for example. But the theology is basically sound. The big problem with Anglicanism is its liturgical forms. So it's worship that needs to be revised first. And it just strikes me as theologically and sociologically interesting that quite often the thing that we are most willing to shrug our shoulders and agree to differ on is worship. And that wasn't the case in the 16th, 17th century. It was vitally important. And as I said yesterday, I think that liturgical practice, without wanting to become a kind of radical orthodox person or go down that kind of line, liturgical practice is formative of who we are. And that the order of worship in whatever context you're working in reflects one's theology to some extent and reflects what you want people to become. So the director of public worship then is the great, it's also it's the document that American Presbyterians forgot. You know, we have to subscribe to two books that I don't think the Westminster Divines ever wanted anybody to subscribe to. The larger and shorter catechisms, we throw those in. We now have to subscribe to the standards, not just the confession. And I think I mentioned before that if you subscribe without exception, like I do, you do so incoherently. Because the larger catechism, I don't think, agrees with the confession on the relationship of church and state. They forgot to change the larger catechism, I think, on that point. But the most important document that the divines thought they were working on is the Directory of Public Worship. And that's the one we kind of forgotten today and left to one side. Come back to talk about that next week. Next week's plan, want to wrap up the Westminster Assembly, want to talk about the death of Puritanism, want to do something on John Bunyan because he's just fun to do. And then I want to conclude the class by looking at Blaise Pascal, who I think was one of the greatest Christian thinkers of the 17th century, and also one of the most fruitful thinkers to read and interact with today. If you're interested in cultural criticism, Blaise Pascal, I think, is far more useful than the sort of the potboiler stuff that is written by and large today. Pascal is a remarkable applier of Augustinian insights to broader cultural issues. Any questions? It was a fairly trolley bus tour today, but you know, we've got a lot. You know, I wanted to cover quite a bit of time. Yeah. Yeah, I think that they're like little gods. They are the reformed answer to Eric Clapton in the 70s century. It's those who have a holy calling, a divine calling. I know some people object to it because they think it's implying they're greater than they were. To me, words are what social convention says they are and mean. For me, I could say the ministers and elders at the Westminster Assembly. Divine is just briefer. I don't know when it became a way of describing these guys at all, but I don't find it particularly obnoxious myself. When I took my vows as an elder in the Free Church of Scotland, I had to subscribe the confession, and I had to vow to uphold the form of worship as outlined in the Directory of Worship for the Free Church of Scotland. So they have their own Directory of Worship, which at that time required me to uphold exclusive psalmody within Free Church congregations. So it's a little looser than RPs. An RP cannot sing a hymn anywhere. As an office bearer in the Free Church of Scotland, I could sing a hymn in a hymn-singing church. What I could not do was go to a free church where the minister said, okay, let's all sing a hymn now in the service. I could not collude with him in his breach of vows, if I could put it that way.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.